Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Kluge v. Brownsburg Community School Corporation, featuring David Quarterman. Our moderator today is Miles Coleman. Miles is partner at Nelson Mullins Riley in Scarborough. Miles represents clients in complex litigation and appeals, advises universities, and serves as outside general counsel for businesses and educators. He also counsels private entities and government officials, including members of Congress and multiple current and former governors of South Carolina, on issues relating to the constitutional and statutory freedoms of speech, religion, and association. His First Amendment work has been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
All right. Thanks, Marco. Welcome, Dave, and welcome to all of those who are with us virtually. We've got a very interesting case to talk about, and I'm looking forward to learning more about it, and I know folks joining us are as well. Before we jump into that, let me give Dave a brief bio. Won't give the full thing because I think I and everybody else would rather hear you talk about the case than just hear about some of your accolades. But just to give a little context, so Dave, you're a senior counsel, vice president of the U.S. litigation at ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've been there for a couple of decades now. I won't try to do the math in my head, but quite a few years, and supervise a team of 40 attorneys and staff who focus on religious freedom, sanctity of life, marriage and family, and other constitutional issues. By my count, you currently have a 2-point lead over me in number of U.S. Supreme Court cases argued, but the game ain't over yet. I'm hoping to maybe pick up speed and catch up to you here at some point. Trinity Lutheran, which, as an aside, we could spend a lot of time talking about Trinity Lutheran, but in my view, I would say that is the seminal modern case establishing sort of an equal access level playing field doctrine for people and institutions of religious identity. And I mean, hardly a week goes by that you don't see a lower federal court somewhere relying on Trinity Lutheran in giving equal access and equal accessibility to people and institutions of faith. So super important case. And then also read the Town of Gilbert unanimous decision there. But we're here to talk about one of your current projects right now today, which is Kluge versus Brownsburg Community. It's possible, I'm sure, that some of the folks on the call are not familiar with the case. So maybe just to start us off with just kind of basic high level factual framework. What's this case about? What's the issue? How did it come into being?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Miles. Thanks for having me on. It's been an interesting case because a lot of what we do is in the context of constitutional law, free speech and freedom of religion and those things. This actually arises in the Title VII context. And that's basically a statute that requires a religious accommodation and forbids or prohibits religious discrimination at the workplace. And so it applies to private employers, it applies to government employers. And so this case arises under Title VII. And that's been interesting too, because I've also had a learning curve. I do most of my litigation in the constitutional realm. And so having to read literally hundreds of cases in the Title VII context preparing for this was certainly educational for me. But the facts basically arise where you have this gentleman, Mr. Kluge, who is the orchestra and music teacher in Indiana, working at the school district for 4 or 5 years. Gets great reviews. The kids love him. He's fantastic. Both teachers and students rave about him. And he's a Christian. and the school decides to pass a new policy. It's basically a pronoun policy, if you will. So they pass a policy that says any students who identify as transgender are allowed in the official school database to change their first names, their preferred names, and their pronouns. Then they actually pass a policy that requires all of the teachers to use those preferred names and preferred pronouns. And so Mr. Klug and a couple of other teachers approach the school district and say, look, it violates our religious beliefs. We believe this to be harmful to the kids. We don't believe it's true that a boy is a boy and a girl is a girl. You can't change from one to the other. And so what's interesting is their first response to Mr. Klug was, you are required to do this. And in fact, they give him three choices, either capitulate, resign, or they fire him. And he says, well, I can't capitulate to this. It violates my beliefs. And so they immediately suspend him. And so they give him the weekend. They come back in on Monday, the first day of school that year. And he says, look, I've come up with this possible accommodation. What about using last names like a coach does? And so we'll be the orchestra team. I'll use last names. I won't use pronouns. I won't use their preferred names or their first names. We'll just use last names. They say, okay, allow them to do it for several months. Some of the students then start complaining because they insist on him using their preferred names and pronouns. And after a few months and a few complaints, they basically fire him without accommodating his religious beliefs. And that's the nutshell of how the case originated.
Okay. And I know, so ADF has handled a couple of pronoun cases in the K-12 public school system. I guess two-part question. One, have you been involved in any of the others? And two, is this the... You mentioned sort of you're unfamiliar with Title VII as a constitutional litigator. Are any of the other cases also Title VII cases, or are they just straight First Amendment?
They're straight First Amendment cases, and they've all come out in favor of the teachers not being compelled to do so, and usually violating their free speech rights under compelled speech. What's interesting is you know, I knew enough about Title VII. I would describe myself to be dangerous, and so you know, in First Amendment law, I've done, you know, hundreds of cases for three decades. And so I'm pretty familiar with the Title VII. I've done some cases, but just enough to get myself in trouble. So it was certainly catching up. And the cases develop, as you know, year after year. And so many of the cases were new or fairly recent under Title VII.
Okay. I've got a bunch of questions about, I guess, the law and some intervening changes in the law. So we've got the kind of gave us the high level facts. Procedurally, I think I saw that this case was argued at the Seventh Circuit very recently, maybe a month or so ago. I guess, how do we get there? What's the posture of it right now?
Yeah, I got to argue the case several weeks ago at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's been ongoing for about 6 to 7 years now. And so originally it was filed in a district court in Indiana, and both sides of the other side of the school district moved to dismiss. The court dismissed a bunch of the claims, but kept the two Title VII claims in. That's the religious accommodation claim that we talked about, that you can't discriminate against religion. You have to accommodate beliefs if you can. And then there's a retaliation claim built in that after the person does or exercises their religious beliefs, you can't retaliate against those. Those two claims were left in the case. The district court ruled for the school district in that case. It went up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals the first time. The Seventh Circuit affirmed the district court, and then we filed for en banc, which is the full Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to hear the case. The first Seventh Circuit, the circuit courts are normally a three-judge panel, but you could move to hear the whole panel. In this case, was 12 judges. And then what happened at that time was, the Supreme Court heard this case called Groff, which was a Title VII case that changed the standard. So then the Seventh Circuit vacated the case, got rid of it completely, sent it back down to the district court to rule on it again under the new standard under Groff. And same thing ended up happening. We lost at the district court, and this is back up to the Seventh Circuit for the second time under the new case.
is, I've admitted at the Seventh Circuit, but don't practice there often. Did you have the same panel the second time around?
We did. Okay. And many of the circuits do that as a matter of course. I'm not sure if it's policy or just practice, but very often if you come back to the circuit court on the same case, they will sit you with the same panel you had in the first place.
Okay. I assume that probably would have been the case. Did you, to the extent that you can read the tea leaves of an oral argument as an advocate, did you subjectively have a different sense of how the court felt about the case second time around post Groff change in the law?
I did, and didn't feel great about it given the way the panel ruled the first time around. But I want to talk about that a little bit because there are reasons for that. And so we were talking about what the standard is under Title VII. And, you know, people don't need to be familiar with all the cases, but there was a case in the late 1970s, which was called TWA versus Hardison. And a lot of these Title VII accommodation cases, they come in the context of taking Sabbath off. So if someone can't work on whatever their Sabbath day is, TWA was a Seventh-day Adventist, couldn't work on Friday to Saturday. The Groff case was an evangelical Christian, couldn't work on Sundays, but that's usually the context they come up in. And in TWA, and I think it was 1977, the court basically held that you have to accommodate this religious practice unless there's this undue hardship, which is the terminology in the statutes under the definition of religion. But they set the standard so low that the terminology was it was a de minimis standard. And all that basically means is just what it sounds like. It's a minimum burden that they have to show. And the court basically said it's something trifling was a word that they used. So if there was anything that any financial expenditure, disruption of the workplace, coworkers complained, that met the standard. So the bar was set really low. So for the last 50 years, all of these Title VII accommodation cases, if the employer shows some de minimis burden, they don't have to accommodate religious belief. So now when we're going back, the Supreme Court in the recent Sabbath case in Groff said no, they didn't want to overrule the case, which you know some people in practice can appreciate. But what they said was, well, we really didn't mean that. That was just kind of a couple lines. The lower courts took it out of a context. But basically, it should be whether the burden is substantial in the overall context of the employer's business. And the court said that has to be something that's hard to bear, that's excessive. And so they went from a trifling burden to a burden that's hard to bear, that's excessive, that's disruptive of the entire workplace. You look at the entire context of what happened. So the reason we felt better this time around was not only was the panel working under a different standard, but certainly a lot tougher for the school to meet when you only had a few kids who were complaining. And their complaint was, I insist someone call me by my new pronoun and my preferred name. And we argued it's no student or school district has a right to compel teachers to use a name or pronoun that violates their religious beliefs. So the ask of the school district was too big and violated the statute.
I'm sure the analogy I'm about to give is not a perfect one-to-one, but for those who like me are probably less savvy about Title VII, it feels almost as if maybe previously you were operating on what we think of like almost a rational basis standard. In other words, a standard like very easy for the defendant to just sort of step over it with a fairly easy showing. And you've now moved up to probably not strict scrutiny, but something more akin, I guess, to an intermediate scrutiny. Like it's an actual hurdle. It can be stepped over, but you'd have to really lift your leg up to climb over this hurdle, not just sort of step over it.
No, I think that's a perfect fit because that's exactly right. And I think you're right about the burden. It's either intermediate or strict, depending on how you look at it. I would argue it's closer to strict just because of all the language and synonyms the court used about it being excessive, about being hard to bear. And interestingly, the Supreme Court in the recent case also said, you know, workplace, you know, coworker complaints is not enough to consider that as a substantial burden, especially if it's animus to the religious beliefs or that they just oppose whatever your religious practice is, which is exactly what happened in this case. They said, well, we don't like the fact that it violates your religious beliefs that you won't use the name we tell you to use. So the workplace grumblings, which is what some of the case law calls it, is not sufficient to rise to that level of that new kind of strict scrutiny. Someone had asked who was on the panel. It was Judge Rovner, Judge Brennan, and Judge St. Eve, this both go-rounds. But I thought they were more receptive, and we could talk about that with the change in standard than the first time around.
I'm gonna act as if my ignorance about Title VII and this case more particularly are a feature and not a bug. So I'm gonna ask questions that probably if I were more up to speed, I would know the answers to, but hopefully a lot of the folks in the audience are like me, somewhat less immersed in these cases than you are.
And if you don't practice in this area, we all are. I mean, it's just the way it is because it's very specific and particular, yeah. And it has its own body of case law. So that's right.
So I hear you talking about Title VII and transgender individuals. And so, of course, my mind jumps to Bostock and Harris Funeral, right? Which was, I think, also a Title VII case that involved a transgender employee, or I guess it's two cases consolidated or combined. So, that's just where my mind goes. It seems like, is that controlling here? Is that at least standard setting? Or like, what's the, I guess, how did those cases, how's that binding precedent interlock with the issues we're trying to grapple with in this case?
Yeah, and it's actually a good question. They both did involve Title VII. They're opposite pieces of Title VII, and I'll talk about that quickly. So in Bostock and Harris Funeral Homes, the question there was, can someone be fired because their gender identity? And the simple question in that case was, when Title VII was enacted, what did sex mean? So what that falls under is you're not allowed to discriminate based on religion. One of the other categories is you can't discriminate based on sex. And so what the court was wrestling with in that case was, does sex include gender identity? Now, the way you're supposed to examine that is you go back in the 70s when the statute was first enacted and you say, what was the normal public meaning? And the gender identity stuff really didn't start developing till more recently. So we thought the answer was pretty easy. Sex meant male and female back then, and that's it. So this isn't protected by Title VII. Here, it's not directly at issue because this is Mr. Klug saying that this was religious discrimination in the workplace, so the same type of protection, but the other side, the balancing, if you will, of whether there's an undue hardship and what's the interest of the government to show, you know, that undue burden, was the fact that these students were identifying as transgender. So they're kind of different pieces of Title VII. They both use the same type of protection. In Bostock and Harris, protection for gender identity. Here, protection for religion. And the only thing the gender identity has here is, was that a sufficient interest to override the religious discrimination in this case? Not that that was a protected status to be protected under.
Correct me if I'm wrong on sort of the premise to the question I'm about to get to, but I guess the premise is, my recollection is that Bostock and Harris left open for another day the question of various affirmative defenses, including the Title VII religious exemption, probably ministerial exception, religious autonomy, RFRA, and maybe some others. Assuming I'm right about that as the premise, I guess the question is, am I right then in thinking none of those open questions are implicated or raised here, because those will all be affirmative defenses raised by the employer, whereas Klug is obviously the employee who's bringing the claim.
That's right. You're right on both of those counts. And what's interesting is that when you look at some of the lower courts who have latched onto Bostock, they tend to downplay, overlook, ignore what you just said. And the court specifically said, we are not dealing with free exercise issues. We're not dealing with pronouns. We're not dealing with sports. We're not dealing with bathroom usage. We're not dealing with any privacy issues. We're specifically leaving that for another day. But you'll see sometimes lower courts in these contexts, there's been cases about bathroom usage and different things like that. Well, they'll latch onto Bostock and just basically say, well, it applies here, even though the court specifically said it didn't. So it's a good point.
I think an interesting point, and this, I'll try not to go too far off onto a rabbit trail here, but since you mentioned how the Bostock court sort of left open some of those. I did not myself watch or listen to the recording of the Scrimeti oral argument, which was about 7 weeks ago. I think it was in early December. But I thought it was very interesting that one of the comments during that from then Solicitor General Preligar was to say, "Whoa, no, we're not getting into that space. This case, we're not talking about bathrooms. Like that's another thing. That's for another day." And it does seem like there's at least a recognition, I think, essentially kind of across the ideological spectrum that that at least under the court as currently composed and precedent as it currently exists, that there are some distinctions between what the standards or the rules might be in different environments.
Yeah, and it's a great point. You're correct about the way that was argued. Interestingly, a little bit inside baseball, the last administration was not taking that position throughout the case or in other cases. When the Solicitor General went before the Supreme Court, she's excellent in her advocacy. She's one of the best I've ever seen. I don't agree with much of the politics or positions, but she's very reasonable in those positions she takes and often backs off of what the government otherwise said previously or briefed. And so those are some new revelations. We agree with them, but it's not the position the last administration was taking in many of the dozens of cases across the country that touch on the issue. But we agree that should be the standard, because if you read the Bostock opinion, it specifically says those things. But the last administration was actually issuing executive orders and guidance to Department of Justice, Department of Education, HHS across the board, saying you should read Bostock to say that any discrimination in Title VII, Title IX that has to do with sex does reach gender identity. And so that was an interesting concession by the general at the court.
So I recognize that what I'm about to say calls for speculation, but I'm going to ask the question anyway, and somebody can object if they want.
Right, we're good at that.
Objecting or speculating.
Speculating and objecting. That's
right. So, I mean, I think we have to assume, I think it's safe to assume that the SG would not sort of back off the position or make a seeming concession or partial concession, obviously without authorization in advance. SG is very high within the DOJ, but not the highest. So we have to assume that was discussed and approved and agreed upon internally by DOJ leadership in advance. I guess my question is this. Do you think, speculating, do you think going into this Scrimeti oral argument, they had already decided affirmatively we are going to back off of that stance? Or was it, let's see how the argument goes, let's call an audible. You're the quarterback here. As you read the field, as you read the defense, you make a call and see if we need to. You got a guess on that?
I do. I think it was contemplated beforehand, knowing it wasn't going to be an argument that was accepted by the court. So I would have to guess it was discussed and decision was made ahead of time. And General Preligar, if you've ever listened to the arguments, does a fantastic job and is very reasonable and often walks back much of what the government has said previously, and I think effectively so.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let me bring us back to Klug. I was just curious about some of that.
No. Yeah. Stuff.
If I were better at this, I would have segued in so much more. One more question about Scrimeti that will get us back to Klug. How about that? As I understand it, one of the issues. Well, I guess let me pause for a second. I'm assuming that everybody else on the call are constitutional law nerds like you and I are, and are familiar with what we're talking about when we keep saying Scrimeti. But 30-second high level overview. Scrimeti is the last name of the Attorney General of Tennessee. Tennessee, it's been a couple of years ago now, several years ago, the Tennessee legislature enacted a statute that, if not completely, at least significantly, limited the availability of what's often referred to as gender-affirming surgery, basically surgical or medical interventions to minors who are diagnosed with or suffering from gender dysphoria or gender dysmorphia. That law got challenged. It doesn't matter for our purposes, but I think the district court may have enjoined it. I think the Sixth Circuit reversed the injunction, and then the Supreme Court took the case, and it was argued December 4th. Anyway, that's Scrimeti for those catching up who aren't familiar with it. the question I was going to ask, this will bring us back to Klug, your Seventh Circuit case. As I understand it, one of the issues that could be resolved by the Supreme Court in Scrimeti, and I don't know if it has to be, so there's a sub-question within the question. I don't know if it necessarily will be resolved, but I think it could be resolved, is whether or not transgendered individuals, the T and LGBT, comprise a suspect class or a quasi-suspect class. So I'm going to try to keep all these questions straight in my own head, and I wouldn't ask this to you if you were a witness in front of a jury, because it's going to be far too complicated. But I guess, number one, is that an issue you think is going to get resolved by the opinion of Scrimeti? Number two, can you kind of briefly describe to the audience, like, what is it, even a suspect class or quasi, right? Because to folks who don't play in the sandbox, you hear that, and it actually has sort of a pejorative implication to it, right? It indicates that the members of the class are suspicious, and that's not what the term means in the law.
Right.
And then third, assuming the Supreme Court rules on that, is the presence or absence of suspect classification going to impact your case, and maybe you'll get to go back to the Seventh Circuit for a third time? That was a lot of questions.
Yeah, no, and I'll see if I can track them all. I don't think it's going to be ruled upon by the court, because normally they don't reach issues they don't have to. And I don't think they have to. I think from listening to the argument and reading the briefing and following the case, it seems to me they'll end up with something that says this is up to the states. The states are generally in charge overall of what's appropriate medical treatment. And the states may go one way, the states may go the other, but the states are the ones who are allowed to make that decision. And so that's why I think it's going to fall. So I don't think it's going to get into all the questions that you discussed about suspect class or protected status. Now, what is that? So people are familiar. In all walks of life, there are protected categories, and you hear them all the time. Usually they're race, religion, national origin, sex. And normally in state and federal law, those are the historical categories that have been discriminated against historically on a higher level than other categories. So they've reached this level of higher protected status, whatever they happen to be. So the question is should we add either sexual orientation or gender identity to these protected classes? And that's been the debate going on since before Obergefell and the marriage issues, and where does that stand? Is it a suspect class anyway? It's supposed to be immutable, which means you can't change it, and it's supposed to be historical, which means it's been around for a long time. And so we don't think it should rise to the level, historically speaking, for all those reasons. It's not immutable. It doesn't have the same history as race and religion and those type of things. So we don't think it should rise to that level. I don't think they're going to reach it in that particular case. I think the last part of the question is, if they did and they ruled it was, would it affect it? It would, because it always does. And here's what I mean by that. It's not directly on point like Bostock, but it flavors the decision. Yeah. So if one side becomes a protected class or a suspect class, if you will, then it seems like any harm to them is more serious and rises to a higher level, if that makes any sense. So it's not directly an issue, because discrimination Klug is his religious discrimination, not gender identity discrimination. But when that flavors it, it definitely affects the outcome, even if.
But it feels too like if the burden the employer, in this case the school district, has to show is, you know, something more than de minimis, that there's some real disruption or burden. I mean, I'm not saying this would be a winning argument, but if I'm putting myself in the employer chair, it does seem like an argument you could make is if gender identity were a protected class, maybe we'll call it that, so a suspect class, it's a little bit clearer, or protected class, it does seem like it would at least give you an argument you can make with a straight face as the employer to say, oh, well, accommodating Mr. Klug puts us at risk of, in some way, entrenching on the rights of a protected class.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right, and is one of the arguments that the school just made here. And a quick jump. So I argued a case called LM recently, which is, if anybody's ever heard of it, it's a kid who went to school with a T-shirt that said there are only two genders. And
was this like in Louisiana or Mississippi?
That was Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and actually, we lost at the district court. Not a surprise. We lost at the First Circuit, which is not a surprise. We are actually asking the Supreme Court to take the case. It's currently being conferenced. We'll find out fairly soon. We hope they do. But that's the argument they made there too. Was even though the school was promoting Pride Week and they were promoting the idea that there's unlimited number of genders, this kid comes to school in a t-shirt that says, look, I think there's only two genders, and they basically suspend him and say, you can't wear that t-shirt. And that was the argument you just said that they made, was like, look, this gender identity is a protected class. And so if you offend them and they don't like it, then that violates their rights and we can't let that happen because that puts us on the legal hook. Same argument was made in Klug. One of their arguments was, look, we're at the risk of potential legal liability, and so that's what creates the undue hardship. Now, the problem with that argument, it falls apart pretty quickly for a lot of different reasons. Number one, they're not a suspect class. But number two, it's not just whether you can be sued as a risk of liability, because you can always be sued. So, for example, if you accommodate someone's religious beliefs, for example, a shift change, the person who had to take over that shift can sue you. So you can always be sued in any context. It's supposed to be that if you're on the razor's edge of liability, not the possibility of being sued. And here, there's no case law to say that not compelling a teacher to use a preferred pronoun that violates the student's rights. There's no case that has ever held that, whether it's in Title VII, Title IX, compelled speech, free exercise. They've all gone the other way. And even the most recent executive order by the Biden administration that was saying that, look, you have to put gender identity as a protected class, including compelling pronouns, was struck down by every court that's looked at it and enjoined by the Sixth and Seventh Circuits. So even the attempts to do that have been legally struck down. So it's not even a legitimate legal argument because it's been rejected everywhere it's been litigated.
I want to ask one more question about that. And I do this with some trepidation because I don't know if I'm going to be able to articulate the question really cleanly, but maybe like force user hand grenades. I'm hoping I can get it close enough that you at least get where I'm trying to go with it. The gist of it is this argument we're discussing, right? Where the employer could say, oh, accommodating you, we recognize, Clue, you've got a right and we need to accommodate to the extent we can, but we also recognize that other people have rights and we're trying to, and the argument which you've described, you'll see this a lot, is that essentially you've got these constitutional rights of different parties that are in tension with each other, and it's a zero-sum game. Somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose. Right. And where I'm going through, like one place I've seen this is, right, so famously, I guess it's been 5 or 6 years ago now, the Supreme Court ruled in Fulton versus Philadelphia that the city can't shut out the faith-based foster care providers. That was a free exercise case brought by the provider. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, we had a case that was the opposite sort of polarity, where the state government had accommodated a faith-based provider, and some folks who opposed that then brought suit in federal court. And so we've got this tension. And so I file a 12C motion for judgment on the pleading saying, Fulton, we win. And the response was, no, 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 that's different. The free exercise says, sure, you have to accommodate them, but that's different. This is an establishment clause case that has no bearing here, which is kind of mind blowing, right? To say that the free exercise clause can require something that the establishment clause forbids. Now in that case, we got it sorted out. And the judge was like, no, that's absurd. And I think the Coach Kennedy case put that to rest as well. Anyway, that was a long wind up. I guess here's the pitch. It kind of feels the same thing here, right? Where an employer could, and maybe the school district has said, sure, you know, you have rights, whether they be, you know, free speech rights or religious rights, but so do they. And so the only way to resolve that tension is to shut you down. How, I'm assuming you disagree with that as I do. What is the proper harmonization of those, if we even concede that they are conflicting, but they are at least different, right? How do we harmonize?
No, it's a good question because there's almost always a balancing of rights, right? In all these cases, whether it's the government's rights against a private person's rights, whether it's two private people and their rights. So it's a good point. There's always a balancing. Where I would start with, let's look at what's on both sides of the equation. So here I would say Mr. Klug clearly has a statutory right to the accommodation of religion. That's clear. Is there a right on the other side? And so right away, I would say there is no conflicting right in this case, because there's no right for a school or a student to compel someone to use a pronoun that they prefer, especially when it violates their religious freedom rights and of course, compelled speech. You don't have to be religious. You still can't be compelled to speak something that violates your conscience or what you believe. So I would say that, yes, you do weigh the rights, but there is no right. There is no corresponding right on the other side. And that's what they try to argue, that there's a risk of legal liability. But of course, they came short. Now, if there is corresponding rights on both sides, you still have to weigh them. Is the interest, and people may be familiar, is it compelling? Is it high enough where the government right supersedes your protection? Now, that's supposed to be rare cases, the Supreme Court has said. So when you have either a statutory right or a constitutional right that's clear on one side, that's usually going to override what's on the other side, unless it's an equivalent right, which usually is not the case. Real quickly on the Establishment Clause, it's interesting that you raise that, because the Establishment Clause, I don't want to call it a relic, but the way it's interpreted now is completely different from 20 years ago. You know, I grew up in the law litigating, like, every case the Establishment Clause was on the other side, and often religious freedom would lose because, well, the Establishment Clause is this big scary monster that, you know, Justice Scalia used to say wakes from the dead and scares children and lawyers, and you know, takes away constitutional rights. But now it's the conflict thing you talked about. So one of the positions we always take is, and think about this for one second, this is another tangent, but I think an important one. Is there and should there be a conflict between two things in the Constitution right next to each other? So when people say, and judges say this, Supreme Court justices have said this, there's often a conflict between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Let's stop for a second and think about that. Really? So the founders basically said, you know, this is one thing when I speak sometimes I kid about. So let's draft this provision, right? Let's put it right next to each other, and let's put them in conflict with each other. And let's let everybody from here on out figure it out where that line is. Like, why would that be? It doesn't make any sense. The point of the two provisions is supposed to be complementary, not conflict. Because why would you put two provisions in the same amendment that conflicts with each other? So the right reading is there's no conflict. It's the Free Exercise Clause is meant to protect to the greatest extent possible people's religious freedom. Any faith, whatever it happens to be, you have the most religious freedom. The Establishment Clause is supposed to prohibit the government from advancing a particular religion or coercing people to violate their religious beliefs or do things religious. So those are harmonious. And so when you have these decades of Establishment Clause cases, and even Title VII, in the first TWA case I talked about, the Establishment Clause played a big part in there, because they said, look, the Establishment Clause doesn't allow us to favor religious people. At most, they've got to be neutral. And the new case law, Abercrombie is a case, and in the Groff case said, no, religion is favored. It has this constitutional right, which makes it favored. So it's not, let's just treat them the same as everybody else. It has this favoring. And so the Establishment Clause isn't really weighing on the scale. But interestingly enough, we still get into that. And when I see these type of decisions now, I think this is the throwback from 20 years ago. So I'm not sure if that answered the particular question. But first thing I'd look at, is there really a corresponding right on the other side? And then there's always going to be a balancing test depending on what standard you're under.
So let me double click on one of the things you mentioned there, because I do kind of want to explore this a little bit more. I'll get close enough to what you said, and if I've misrepresented what you said, you clarify. But something along the lines of that a student, let's focus on the student, not the school. A student doesn't have a right, constitutional or otherwise. I suppose you could enact a statute saying that students have a right to be called by any name at all. But in the absence of a statute, and I doubt there is one, they don't have a constitutional right to be called by the name or the pronoun that they wish. And that distracts me a little bit. I sat here trying to think for a while of if I were that student's counsel, what argument would I make? And I guess let's assume that you're right, because you probably are. It feels like in some way, and I'm going to connect the dots here in a second. It's not a perfect analog, but in some ways, like sort of a positive rights, negative rights dichotomy. And there's a factual aspect of this too, right? It's not that your guy Klug want to call them the name they don't want to be called, or the pronoun they don't want to be called, which I guess in this case, that would be sort of a negative, right? Right. The student would want to be protected from a positive action and an affirmative act. It's just that he doesn't want to do a thing. He's trying to refrain from acting.
Right. He's trying to be silent when they're compelling him to speak. That's right.
And so I guess the question is, legally, would the analysis be different if the facts were different? Obviously, we're going to a hypothetical, sort of a counterfactual world here. If your guy, or let's make it a hypothetical other person at a different school district, said, no, I actually have a, let's not make it religious, right? Let's neutralize things a little bit. I have a philosophical belief. I'm an atheist. I'm a scientist, a materialist, but I believe that chromosomes are what they are. They can't be changed, and it's objectively true, and I refuse to do otherwise. I'm going to call you the name you don't want to be called. Yeah. Is that scenario analytically different from yours?
I think it's different in large part, and I'll talk about a few reasons why I think that. It's a much stronger case to say the school district or the students, whoever, are compelling me to say something that violates my beliefs. I don't want to be forced to speak it. I want to remain silent on this issue, gender identity in this particular case. That's a pretty strong argument. Let's come to some other solution. And the solution he proposed was, let's use last names. Interestingly, and as another little side note, it was the school district's burden under the statute to provide him an accommodation and to come up with one, not for him to have to come up with one. He was criticized by the district court judge of not coming up with enough of accommodations. Well, he doesn't have to come up with any. And he did come up with one that worked, we thought worked. The school district didn't carry their burden to come up with any. That's a little side note. But let's take that same scenario, and this is why we feel like we do. For you to say, if someone says, please don't call me that, I don't like it, hurts my feelings, it's not who I am, and you insist on doing so, raises other problems, raises problems under other types of policies, raises other types of issues. And the way I always look at it is, if you flip your hypo to the other side, right, to the people who are doing what you don't want them to do, would a teacher have a right to say to Johnny that I think you're truly a girl, and I'm going to call you she, and I'm going to call you Sally, even though you don't want to be, right? So if you flip that scenario, and we say, no, both sides of it, whether you're Mr. Klug not wanting to call a biological boy a girl's name or pronoun, or someone who's on the other side saying, I want to call the biological boy a girl, just because I think you are. I think you're mistaken in what you believe and what you perceive yourself. We would say neither one of those has a right to do that affirmatively, calling you what they think you are. And so we always look at not just what's best for my client or what's best for this particular situation. What's the principle that should apply across the board to everybody, whether they agree or disagree, like the t-shirt case? We say, well, there are only two genders. Well, we're not stopping the school or other students from saying we believe there are unlimited genders, but don't shut out my viewpoint too. Like, you can't just take one viewpoint and say that's okay, but you can't disagree with it. And so the kind of free speech principle, the Title VII principle is you treat everybody the same when it's under the same type of principle, whether you agree with that particular thing or not.
But it almost feels like the outcome that feels right, that feels just, is maybe different in the two cases, right? So in your t-shirt case, that it just feels right to say the solution to speech you don't like, school, is more speech. It's not censorship. It's more speech. Like, you wear your t-shirt, everybody else can wear their t-shirt. This is sort of the Westboro Baptist funeral protest, right? Where if you don't like what they're saying, if you find it offensive, then the solution isn't to shut them up, but to, you know, bring in the motorcycle gang and just drive in circles and drown them out. More humorously, perhaps, in South Carolina several years ago, many years ago, when there was, at the time, a great controversy over the Confederate battle flag, which was being flown at ground level on the State House grounds. There was some sort of a gathering of folks who were engaged in some unpleasantness. And some guy from the Carolina marching band was out there with a sousaphone, and he just marched back and forth in front of them all day, like playing marching band songs, which as a former low brass member of the band, I found both heartwarming and slight yours. But on the one hand, it seems like, right, that's a more speech situation. In some ways, it feels like for Klug, the harmonizing of everybody's interests is just the avoidance of compulsion, right? That Klug, we're not going to force you to say something that you would rather not. At the same time, though, for the transgender student, we're not going to force you to be called something, affirmatively called something that you don't want to be, right? So
it's almost a less speech. Yeah, absolutely. And let's come up with a compromise, right? So this is Mr. Klug loves his students. They love him. He's not trying to be difficult. In fact, he's going out of his way to say, look, I understand these kids are going through difficult times. They need help. I don't think this is helping them. I think this is hurting them. Let's come up to some compromise and say, let's do something else that they can live with, I can live with, I don't have to violate my face, but not to say you have to do this. And I think that matters drastically, because you do want to do it in a spirit of cooperation. There's rights, there's statutes, there's issues, but this is the teacher. And again, he does a great job with kids. He's invested in them and has great accolades, but wants to come up with some solution everybody can live with, not do this or you're fired. And I think that was the big mistake here.
Does it make a difference at all legally that at first the school accommodated him for some period of time, I don't know if it was months or a year, and then took it back? Does that make a difference? I mean, the optics are different versus if they had just said from the outset, nope, sorry, man, not doing it, you're fired.
Yeah, that was their main argument is look, we were accommodating him. We tried it for all those months, but then there was disruption at the school because there was complaints. So it was important to their argument. The problem with it is a few reasons. One of it was they're required by law to come up with some accommodation. The nice thing about Groff said, even if there's a particular accommodation that didn't work, you have to provide some necessary alternative. You have to explore to see if there's something else. And they never did. So not only did they not come up with that accommodation in the first place, he did. They never came up with an alternative one. And Groff said, you're required to. So that's important on the front end. The other thing was it showed that in this particular instance, there was a teacher who was the club advisor for the Equality Alliance Club. He was the generator of all the complaints. So you have one teacher who disagrees with Mr. Klug's views, gets the students going, keeps reporting, but he was the one kept reporting back to the administration. Oh, students aren't liking this. We got to fire him. This isn't okay. What he should have done was said, look, this is bothering some students. Let's see what we could work out. Let's talk to Mr. Klug. Let's have a compromise. Telling the students that they don't have a right to this. And one other point I want to bring in quickly is, the school passed this transgender question policy. And in the policy, it said, teachers are required to use the name and pronouns. We're not doing any other accommodation. We're not doing last names. Basically, you have to do this, which violates Title VII on its face. But interestingly, they carved out several exceptions to that. And what they said was, we're requiring gender identity to be affirmed by everybody. That's the first mistake. You can't require your teachers to affirm gender identity. But they said was, but we're not going to do it in locker rooms and changing rooms. You can't use that by gender identity. You can only use that by biological sex. So they made an exception. Overnight field trips, you can't sleep based on gender identity. You have to sleep based on biological sex. And in one of the school's databases. So one of the arguments I made at the Seventh Circuit was, look, they're saying we can brook no exceptions to our policy. It's that important of an interest. It's an undue hardship if we don't. They made three exceptions themselves. So why could they carve out three exceptions to affirming gender identity and not do one that the law requires them for Mr. Klug? And so that's one of the arguments I made, where their arguments kind of folded on themselves, if you will.
We've got 10 minutes left. I've got a couple of questions I want to ask. And since I'm the one whose camera and microphone are on, I'm going to ask my questions. And then we also got some in the Q&A that in my good pleasure, maybe I'll ask some of those too. I'm going to try to speed up a little bit though, because I, in all seriousness, I do want to get some of those questions. First one, your guy, Klug, feels as a matter of conscience that he can't do this. Anecdotally, in my own experience, I know some people who, as a matter of their faith, have that same objection. And I know plenty of people, I have no idea what the percentage are, but I know plenty of people who are devout people of deep faith who don't feel an objection to using the name or pronoun preferred by the recipient. Does it make a difference, right? Like RFRA, you've got sincerely held religious belief. In the Title VII context, does it make a difference, I guess, whether and how deeply sincerely his belief is? How do you prove that? Does he need to point to a Bible verse? Does he need to point to a written dogma, depending on his faith tradition? Like, what's the analysis there?
Yeah. It does matter, but only minimally. And here's what I mean by that. The court has said over and over again that the government can't question the centrality of your beliefs. So if you say, look, and this goes to the difference you meant, I've been praying about this and I'm okay using their preferred name and pronoun, that's fine. If you say, look, I can't use their name and pronoun because of my religious beliefs, the government has to accept that. Doesn't have to be backed up by your church. You don't need a note from your pastor. You don't need your doctrine to be the same. It's based on your religious beliefs. Now, what they can challenge is the sincerity of it, as in, is this a sham? In other words, is this truly your religious beliefs, or are you just making this up because you don't want to do this thing? And oddly enough, Mr. Klug, they try to make that argument that it wasn't sincere, it was a sham, because in one particular award ceremony, he decided it was okay for him to use their preferred first name. And his response was, the reason I did that was, my objection is to affirming their gender dysphoria. That's harmful to them. Every day in class, using the wrong name and wrong pronoun affirms that. In one particular award ceremony that's more formal, a coach is going to use their last name and say, hey, Coleman. He's going to be more relaxed because of you know, what the surrounding is. So in that one instance, I will agree to do so, but I can't the rest of the time. And they said, see, it shows it's a sham. Well, it's hard to accept that argument because he gave up his entire career that he loved and was great at for his religious beliefs. Hard to say he was just kidding about it or he was just making it up. So that one instance isn't enough to say it was a sham, especially because he explained his religious beliefs and why it didn't violate that. And right. So there shouldn't be any questioning. You don't need a note from your pastor. You don't need to show, look, this is what our presbytery in that particular case says. It shouldn't be questioned unless it's obvious, because there are cases where they say, nah, you know, it's not merely my religion, but I really believe strongly about this. And they can say, well, that's not your religious beliefs, or it's just a sham. You're just saying that to get out of whatever it is.
Have any of these pronoun cases, well, I know none of them have been decided by the Supreme Court, no cert grants yet. Have any of them been on cert petition yet? And if so, why was cert denied?
Yeah, I don't think yet. And they're getting there. Some of the issues, like the surrounding issues with Scrimeti and the executive orders from Biden, have gone their way up to the Supreme Court, and injunctions have been given against them, but not the specific pronoun issue. There's cases, we've got several percolating their way up. The court's going to have to take it at some point because there are people losing their jobs over this, and so we think it's one that the court is going to take pretty soon.
I'm sure most of our attendees know this, but right, to get a case in the Supreme Court, you've got to have obviously an issue of federal law. But at an oversimplified level, right, you need a circuit split. You need courts in some federal courts of appeals holding one way and some holding another way. So a split needed resolution. And then the somewhat more amorphous good vehicle, right? Like, there's not weird facts or bad facts or limiting facts or assuming facts. In the pronoun context, do you have a sense of whether the Supreme Court would be more or less likely to take one of these cases if it arose from a Title VII context or a compelled speech argument or both or something else?
Yeah, here's how I would respond. I don't know if it would matter. I think the facts of the case and how it came there would matter more than whether it's Title VII or free speech. And here's what I mean by that. If the Seventh Circuit here ruled against us again, I think that would be a good case to go up, because it would clearly, in my opinion, fly in the face of Groff that they just ruled on. So it would be the circuit court saying, even though you changed the standard to this strict scrutiny, this heightened scrutiny, we're going to rule on it as if it was de minimis still. So I think in that context, it would. Hoping they take the LM shirt, because that issue is there. We have some other cases going up that have to do with different issues on gender identity, including the pronouns. So it really does, as you said, is, are there disagreements among the circuits? The Supreme Court's, one of their jobs is to make sure federal law is uniform across the country. You shouldn't have particular rights in certain states and not the same rights in other states. So I think that does bode well toward them taking a case if there is a circuit.
And you may have answered my next one. Likely, I guess let me ask it slightly differently. So if the Seventh Circuit rules against you, you'll seek cert, assuming they're not going to rule the basis of unresolved fact or something like that. Because the case is there on a dispositive post-discovery motion on summary judgment. So do you think if they rule in favor of your client, you have a guess of whether the school district wants to see this one try to go the distance, or if they'll just take the loss and move on?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. The reason is it surprises me the cases that the other side takes up and continues to litigate, like the Trinity Lutheran case. You know, they're giving out playground resurfacing grants to everybody, and it's to make sure kids don't get hurt when they fall on the playground. They say, yeah, all these type of schools can get this, but if you're at a religious school, what, they want the kids getting hurt there? Like, I just don't understand sometimes why they do. So I don't know the answer to the question, but they dig in their heels often because the principles they believe in, they're like, well, we think the court's wrong, or we think this administration is wrong. So it wouldn't surprise me, because they fought it for this long. This is going on, as I mentioned, 7-8 years. It wouldn't surprise me if they continue to fight this.
Okay. Let me try to move through some of the Q&A questions. This one hopefully is short. What has Mr. Klug been doing for the past 7 years?
Yeah, I mean, he's been, I think he works for a painting company. And one of the problems with, we were talking about sincerity, this was his career. This was his degree. He specialized in to get a music degree that many levels up is difficult to get. And then when this happens, no one's going to hire you. And that's essentially what happens in these type of cases. Like, people think, oh, just go get another job. It's not that easy.
Do you think, I'm gonna shorten something if I can. In sort of vernacular, legal vernacular, we use the term biological sex. And by that, we mean sort of natal sex or chromosomal sex. Question is, does that framing of it, does the use of the qualifying word biological in front of the word sex, yeah, essentially play into or acknowledge that there is something other than just sex? Like, does that make sense? What the question is, like, can
no,
we just
it,
say
it
sex?
Does. It does, and I agree. And we like to say just sex because there's only two, and that's it. The problem is, depending on the audience, and often in court and judges, they don't see it that way. So sometimes the reason we use biological is just to make clear what we mean. But I agree with you 100%. Sex should be all you need to say.
Okay. Next question. This is one that you could probably write a law review article about, but instead I'll ask you to answer it in 60 seconds. The question is, generally, do you see Supreme Court precedent as supporting the idea that compelling speech presents a bigger problem than forbidding speech?
Yeah. The court treats them both the same in the standard strict scrutiny of the violation, but I think there's an edge to the compelling speech being worse, more protected. And the reason is there's some case law that basically says that's a dignity harm when you are forcing someone to say something that violates their beliefs, as opposed to prohibiting them from saying something. So the technical answer is they're on the same level, but I think in reality, compelling someone's speech is a little bit worse than prohibiting it in the court's eyes.
Okay. I don't think I'm going to try to squeeze in another one. We're wrapping it up. We're at the end of the hour. I guess let me just ask this to land the plane. For folks interested in learning more about this case and some of the others you mentioned, the teacher case and others, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, adflegal.org is our website. There's a search bar on the top. You just type in Klug, and everything we have on Klug, attached pleadings, press releases, videos. So any of our cases, you can just type in the name of the case. A lot of it's on the front page. And then there's a whole breakdown of everything on the website for all of the cases.
Okay. Well, we're right at an hour. Dave, thanks for your time. I hope this was as interesting and informative and educational to everybody as it was to me, but we appreciate it. Thanks for the update. And I guess we'll keep our ears tuned to hear what happens.
We're waiting for an opinion, hopefully an opinion to be out in the next couple of months, and we'll see how it goes and go from there.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you for your time. Thanks, everybody. And we'll call it a wrap.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.